Consumer Focus with Martin Newman.
Hello and welcome to Consumer Focus, bringing you expert advice and opinion on customer service and the British High Street. My name is Martin Newman. I've worked in e-commerce and digital and retail for nearly 35 years now, and I've dedicated to championing the consumer and helping businesses to develop the best strategies for their customers. I am delighted and very honoured to be joined by Philip Graves, who is an expert in customer behaviour and author of the best-selling book Consumerology. I founded a business called Practicology, so we really ought to go into talking about orologies at some point today. Consumerology, which rips up the traditional textbook on how we read customer data. In addition to his first book, Consumerology, Philip writes articles and white papers for a number of organisations, and since 2012, he's written a regular column on consumer psychology for The Marketer, which is the magazine of the Chartered Institute of Marketing. And he also writes guest articles for Frontier Economics and Cambridge Business. Welcome, Philip. Thanks for joining us on this lovely sunny day in London. What I'd like to ask you first of all really is, what made you decide to write Consumerology? And what a great title, by the way.
Well, I have the publishers to thank for that.
So. Right.
I had spent a lot of time in the world of market research, and I was intrigued by the times, which seemed quite frequent, when research was wrong. I also developed an interest in psychoanalysis. And it seemed to me that the fundamental principle within psychoanalysis is that people don't understand themselves. And yet when we go to most market research, the fundamental principle is that consumers do understand themselves. Mm-hmm. So I really started to write the book taking forward my hypothesis that they don't, and looking to see where the evidence was for that.
So when you, can I just ask you something briefly, if you don't mind? So when you say they don't understand themselves, what do you, could you just elaborate on that? What do you mean by that?
Well, fundamentally what I mean is that most market research, although it may dress it up slightly differently, mm-hmm. is centered on the principle that if I ask you a question about something, mm-hmm. you know, your attitudes, your opinions, whether you'll buy a product, what, how you want to be served in a mm-hmm. shop, that you will give me an answer that is fundamentally true. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge amount of evidence to the point to the fact that that's not true. And it emanates from what we've learnt over the last 40, 50 years in behavioural psychology, although actually the clues go back much further, mm-hmm. which is that there is a large part of our brain, which is given various different names. Kahneman calls it System 1. I would refer to it as the unconscious mind, that drives a huge proportion of our behaviour. And the reason it's called the unconscious mind within psychology is because we have no direct access to it. Mm-hmm. So if we've got no direct access to a large part of the decision-making components in our head, how on earth would we be able to accurately voice what it is we want or what it is we think about things? Because we're essentially, when we're asking people questions, we're going in through the conscious part of the mind, mm-hmm. and we're interrogating the wrong part of people's heads.
Right, okay. Interesting. When did you write Consumerology?
It was published in 2010, so it was written. I started writing it probably in about 2008 and then got delayed by the Labour Party's inability to decide when they wanted to hold a general election, which was deemed a poor time to publish a book.
To publish a book, right. Too many other things going on. Arguably now might not be the right time either, with Brexit and all that nonsense kicking off. What experiences do you have as a consumer that really frustrate you? I mean, we just had a quick conversation there about where you went for breakfast this morning. Maybe we won't shout out the name of that place, but it'd be interesting just to hear the experience that you had there and any other experiences that you have personally that frustrate you when you're out and about.
Well, what I think I'm quite in tune with as a consumer because of the work that I do, although I don't think these are things that many people would argue with, is the extent to which what we're really looking for as consumers is ease and fluency most of the time. And quite often organisations will, either because of an inability to prioritise that, or because they are overly prioritising something else, like believing they're offering a fantastic kind of culinary experience, mm-hmm. which I think was the issue this morning, even though it was just, in inverted commas, a cafe, that... what happens is you get these points of friction that essentially are hugely inefficient that get between you and the consumer outcome that you desire. And yep. It's normally desire, not need, although marketeers often talk about need, separate point. And it's unnecessary. And were they able to stand back and actually appreciate how consumers' minds work and the fact that actually what we're trying to do the vast majority of the time is ration cognitive effort to have things be as simple and as unthinking as possible. And arguably that's what brands do brilliantly. It's not that our minds light up with affection when we see them. It's that they save us having to think too much. And so when I see organisations, often with good intentions, failing to grasp that fundamental aspect, and it's something which is fundamental because it plays to our evolutionary psychology. It's how we've always been. It's not going to change.
Sure.
That they essentially make things harder for everyone, including themselves.
Can you give me some practical examples of how that manifests itself in terms of those sort of points of friction or just bad experiences that you've had recently?
Ordering a coffee, we have a sort of a sense of expectation about how long a coffee will take to get.
Yeah.
Which is driven by some sometimes derided national, international businesses like Starbucks,
yep.
and there are many others, who have recognised they need to make things easy,
yep.
and they're brilliant at it. And it's, you know, as much as people might want to be snooty about them, people sometimes get upset about large business. It's the best indication that what they're doing is right, because behaviourally they've been able to expand and be profitable and
sure.
grow. And Starbucks go to the extreme of, you know, they don't mind having two branches within sight of each other, because they recognise people won't walk too far to get a coffee. They won't cross the road. They, you know, they've understood that about people. And so I have an unconscious expectation of how long a coffee will take to make and the amount of urgency that will go into that. Now, that's not a sort of a fixed amount of time I hold in my head, and it's based on the context I'm in. If there are a lot of people ahead of me in the queue, I know intuitively it will take a little bit longer. When I'm the only person there, there are a couple of people loitering in the background. Mm-hmm. There are two people behind the counter serving, and that coffee seems to take, feels like 5-10 minutes to arrive, and there's no acknowledgement of what the issue is.
Mm.
I just stand there feeling a sense of frustration
sure.
that I can't get on with the day that I want. And
sure.
then you add to that the choices they've made about their range of food, which require you to kind of think, well, do I want to try something new? This is not something I would normally have.
Mm-hmm.
That might seem adventurous and exciting. And indeed, if you ask people about it, so do you want the same old stuff or do you want something new and exciting? They'd probably say, oh, I want something new and exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, when you're pressed for time, you're trying to get somewhere in the morning. In a sense, you're trying to get a fix of chemicals that will lift you so you can achieve the thing that you're really focused
sure.
on. They're letting you down.
Yeah. Interestingly, I am a fan of Starbucks. In fact, I'm so sad I often book hotels and holidays when I travel and make sure that they're in walkable within walkable distance of a Starbucks. That's how much I need my coffee burst in the morning. I have to say, though, I do feel often when I go in to any of those, whether it's Starbucks, Costa Coffee, Cafe Nero, because I would generally drink from all three, although Starbucks would be my favourite. I do feel there's a process optimization opportunity there, you know, and invariably think it does seems to take them a while to, I think the average is about 7 minutes, 7.5 minutes or something, to get the coffees out. But anyway.
And they don't get it all perfect.
No, they,
so,
do, not. They do not.
You know, the moment when Starbucks started deciding they needed to ask me my name to give me my coffee,
yes.
You know, they were certainly in this country breaking a social barrier that
yeah.
didn't need to be broken.
Yeah.
That was hugely misjudged.
Yeah,
but,
no, I agree.
But I understand why they did it,
sure.
but it was the wrong solution to the problem.
I agree. Well, I've been called all sorts of things, I think. I think 9 times out of 10 they misspell my name. I think I've even been called Martha, but there you go. What for you is bad market research? So you started talking about research earlier, but what gets lost in the stats and the numbers? Can you give us some insight into that, please?
Well, fundamentally, bad market research is market research which fails to acknowledge the significance and importance of the unconscious mind in consumer behaviour. And the vast, vast majority of interrogative market research, where we're asking people questions, fundamentally neglects that. It takes no account of it. So that's...
Can you give us some examples of what you would be trying to tap into in the unconscious mind? What are those decisions that consumer... Well, they're not decisions because they're unconscious. So how do you access that and what are they basically?
Well, we have evolved with a fast-working part of our brain that has a number of traits, for want of a better expression. They're sometimes called biases within behavioural economics. I don't particularly like that term.
Because you do or you don't?
I don't. It's a pejorative term. Or it's taken to be. Technically, it's right.
Yeah.
But it quite often is taken by people to see and be seen as a bad thing.
Right.
And this is just a reflection of how our brains are. So, and it reflects the fact that the way we make decisions ends up being influenced by things like the feeling that we have that we might feel bad as a result of doing it, something known as loss aversion. Mm-hmm. We're influenced, we know, by how things are framed, so what's around something when we're making a decision. Mm. Our attention is a very unconsciously controlled and selective thing. So just because something exists, so you create your new product, mm-hmm. And you want to understand how people react to it, well, you put it in front of people and ask them. Well, you've fundamentally crossed over a barrier there to the unconscious mind, which is, do they even notice it when it's in its real environment? Mm-hmm. So there are a whole host of these things, and underneath that there are sort of our basic psychological desires that orientate our behaviour. Yours will be slightly different to mine. Again, they're a consequence of evolution, but it's important to recognise that, you know, what might be propelling someone towards a product, perhaps because they think it imbues them with a sense of tremendous status, mm-hmm. and that's important to them. And in the past, we needed people who had high status, mm-hmm. Or whether someone is driven by a huge sense of community and social honour, which, again, we needed when we were in small groups to protect.
But those examples that you've given there, I mean, would those be something that consumers would normally be conscious of?
No, not at all.
No, so those are in the unconscious mind,
absolutely.
Basically. Those are, okay.
So failing to take account of that, I think, is the biggest issue. And there's something which relates to that, which is that because so much of our behaviour is driven by the unconscious mind, the way in which soliciting someone's view on something is done is intrinsically influencing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of market research companies would say, oh, no, we're aware of that. We take great care with question design. Well, it's just not possible to do it, ultimately. Mm-hmm. There are ways of soliciting how people think that I've developed, but they're nothing like the techniques that are used in, say, a standard questionnaire. And they don't lend themselves to quantitative measurements. Mm-hmm. They're things that work in a qualitative setting. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is best illustrated that when I was researching the book, it's very rare that you come across two studies that are done at the same time in the same way, because people normally do something once, they go, okay, that's the answer. But I found one, and it was where there was a political fight going on between the BBC, or the BBC Trust, and the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. Mm-hmm. What they were going to do with money that was left over from digital switchover in the licence fee, without which to bore you with all the details. But the crux of the matter was, they went off, they asked consumers what they wanted, and the answers were 60 percentage points apart.
Right.
Now, I could trace, through looking at the questions that were asked, the trail of psychological influence that had led to that divide.
Right.
But it shows you how arbitrary, in a sense, the number that emerges is if you aren't cognizant of the fact that
you ask the wrong questions, basically.
Well, or even that you ask the questions.
But may influence people in a way, or too overtly, essentially.
Well, yeah, although, you know, one of the questions that comes out of that is which is the right answer, and the answer is neither of them. It wasn't possible to get to a right answer because the fact was nobody really knew that this money had been added onto the license fee for this reason.
Right.
No one thought about it, and no one was likely to think about it later. Mm. So someone needed to make a decision. It was going to be a difficult decision. It was a complex decision. But asking consumers what they, quote, wanted, and we run the risk of getting into Brexit-type debates here, was frankly an oversimplification, because you were never going to be able to represent that question in a sufficiently detailed and contextually appropriate way.
Well, as Henry Ford is famously quoted as saying, if I'd asked customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. So I think that's a fairly good example. That's a nice segue into what I want to talk about now, which is really about, consumer-facing businesses and how they can go about being more effective at turning data into insight. You know, I'm not a lover of what I call BS bingo. You know, we use a lot of terminology. I think what you're talking about is very scientific and very relevant, but, you know, we use terms like big data. And I suppose my issue with big data is that it's a buzzword, which, to be totally honest with you, I'm not sure even today I really know what it means. What I'm always much more interested in is insight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to give you a very quick example, as someone who used to basically be responsible for reporting the performance of e-commerce and multi-channel retail when I was on the client side at brands like Harrods, Burberry, Ted Baker and so on. You know, sitting in a trading meeting on a Monday, I had more KPIs than you could shake a stick at. I had average order values, I had units per transaction, I had traffic, I had dwell time, I had returns rates and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, what I would suggest is that those are the outputs, not the inputs. Those KPIs don't really tell me why things are happening in the business. They tell me ultimately what the outcome has been, but not how we got there. So have you got any tips or any thoughts on how, you know, consumer businesses can do a better job of actually surfacing insight?
Short answer, yes. Probably a good thing, given the context we're in. Now, I wouldn't challenge your your sort of premise there entirely. But what I see an awful lot in organisations is they, and it's probably that there is, you know, the two extremes exist, and actually what we're looking for is something in the middle, that a lot of organisations ignore behavioural data. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge mistake, because behavioural data, whilst it doesn't tell you the why, does tell you the what in a way that is true. Now, at the other end of the extreme, you have survey data, which tells you, purports to tell you the why, but is in almost all instances not true. And so in our desperate need to get to the why, I see a lot of organisations ignoring the what. And I would always say, you have to start with facts and accept that there is a limit to what they can tell you. And so that gets you so far. Where you go from there depends on the problem that you're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. If you have the behavioural data pointing to a particular picture, and this is so to give you a tangible example of something I've worked on, I've worked with clients where they've had a group of customers who are buying a lot, and I'll, you know, make this a sort of dumbed down example for my own sake and for confidentiality reasons, but you've got a group of customers who are buying a lot. You've got another group of customers who, to all the data you've got, look exactly the same as those first customers, but they're not buying anywhere near as much. Mm-hmm. We'd like them to buy more. Okay. Now what do we do? Well, that's where psychoanalytical interviewing techniques can come in, because you can take these people knowing what their behaviour is and take the other people knowing what their behaviour is and explore how they experience the brand in question, the product or service in question, and to understand why that is different. And when you understand that, and it's very often down to drivers at an unconscious level, when you understand that, it gives you the insight that is the platform for the creativity that can move you somewhere else. So you can then start to say, well, okay, we could change these things so we don't destroy what we know is working for the group who are currently buying from us a lot, but so that we can broaden our appeal or increase our appeal with this other group.
Sure.
But an important part of that, it is a creative process that follows. Consumers can't tell you what to do, and they won't tell you what to do. They're hopeless at it, and you know, it's just not practical. There's no evidence they've ever been very good at it. And then you get into the next stage, but this can also help with the diagnosis, which is if you're able to run randomized control trials, and that's not the same thing as one pilot, but where you can test things in a way that is valid, that's putting things in front of consumers where the environment is present, they're actually behaving as they would as consumers, they're not being asked questions, you can get genuine insights that are hugely reliable, and that will tell you, one, what works, but also what doesn't work, which will inform your view of what's working in that data. And one of the reasons we see technology businesses, young technology businesses, being many, many times more efficient than established non-technology businesses is because when they're young, they tend to be very responsive to behavioural data. Now, as they grow, and I have experience of this working with one of the biggest technology companies, they lose sight of that. Mm-hmm. And they start trying to retrofit traditional marketing approaches, and it's a car crash. Mm-hmm. And they end up being very bad at doing things. But in those early stages, it's that informed perspective that, one, you've got to really know what the what is. And that's where the economics come in, because you can identify, well, which are the important behaviours that we need to understand.
Sure.
And then use the right tools to understand those so that you can develop the trials that will enable you to explore what can
that
change.
That sounds like a good approach. Really, where I was going with that was, I mean, from a KPI perspective, a lot of those KPI, some of them are behavioural, some of them aren't really. I mean, if I say to you, you know, conversion rates are 1% this week, when last week they were 1.5%, the first thing you're going to want to know is why. Why have they dropped? And I think that the challenge that a lot of people face still in those trading roles in consumer businesses is they haven't got answers to that. And it's how you get into how you are able to drill into that. And I think a lot of the answers in that are about customer behaviour, mm-hmm. and are about how different segments, and you were touching on segmentation there, how different segments of customers behave differently. They may demographically look the same, but fundamentally, you know, they have a different approach to what they buy and how much they spend. And then drilling into that and understanding why. So I think that's some pretty good insight. Tell us more about, please, you have this, what we call an effect approach. So I think it's spelled AFECT. Is that right?
That's correct.
Tell us what that approach looks like and what creates good customer insight then.
So one of the things that I got to in writing the book was having torn into market research and said, look, here are all the problems with it. Was there a way of giving people an easy tool so that when they're faced with consumer research insight or alleged insight, they could ask themselves a series of questions to say, well, actually, how much should I believe this? Because what we often see is it's the voice of the consumer. Mm-hmm. It must be true. We, you know, hopefully by the end of chapter one, you've dismissed that notion. And so what I realized was that there were five questions you could ask yourself. And the more of these you could say yes to, the more confident that you could be that what you had was psychologically valid. Now, what we tend to focus on in insight is statistical validity. And I have no issue with statistical validity from a mathematical point of view. And in fact, back in the day, I was a statistician. I get what statistical validity is about. But the problem is that if what you have is a statistical confidence interval on a number, or a level of statistical significance related to a number, that has absolutely no meaning because it connects to something that people cannot answer reliably, the psychological validity part of it, you have essentially something worse than useless, because you've got a number that you believe that isn't true, and you've put mm-hmm. confidence on that number using statistics mm. that, you know, are devoid of the real confidence you should have in that. So, five questions to ask yourself. The first one is it an analysis of behaviour? Are you looking at something that is a reflection of what people do, not what people say? Mm-hmm. And if it involves behaviour, generally that's a good thing. The F is, what frame of mind were people in at the time when this was collected? Mm-hmm. So in one extreme, you've got people who are in a retail setting who are behaving just like consumers, and they're doing whatever they normally do. In another, you've got people who are sitting down saying, well, I'm going to ask you some questions. Or worse still, meet seven strangers. We're all going to talk about this thing you do as a consumer. You know, you've created a frame of mind where I'm mm-hmm. thinking much more about, well, what does Martin think about me and how do I look if I say this?
Yeah.
Not necessarily consciously.
It's
but
not natural, really, is it?
No. Yeah. And, I don't know what I think. Oh, Martin's just said this, so I'll say that too.
That's, sure.
Again, not consciously, but we see those dynamics time and time again. The E is particularly important, which is environment. So we know in behavioural psychology that a huge influence on our behaviour is context. So, for example, if I said to you, you're working on the most important piece of work you've ever done, and someone comes in, starts messing around and throws coffee all over it, how would you feel? You would probably find it quite easy to say, this is how I feel angry, I'd do this, I'd do this. Now, actually, you're lying.
Yep.
because it depends on the context. If the context was that the most important potential client in the world had just done this, or, you know, someone you admire enormously, or a child with special needs, your response would be reflective of that context. Mm-hmm. Now, from a consumer point of view, we see things like light, colour, framing, who you're with when you're shopping, all these sorts of things influence how people respond, and sure, they respond very differently at a different time. Mm-hmm. So if you strip away all of that environment when you're evaluating how consumers might respond, you're stripping away a large part of what's processed unconsciously and influences how we behave. Yeah. So you have to make sure the environment is represented somehow, mm-hmm, and there are different ways of doing that. So that's the environment. C is covert. The focus of what you're doing needs to be covert. There's a really big problem that as soon as I say to you, oh, today we're going to talk about this, or it's obvious what it is we're looking at, you know, your mind will start thinking, okay, well, where might this be going? You'll turn it into a narrative, you'll create a journey. And that makes what we're doing very artificial. It's also a problem that as soon as I force your attention at something and it's not concealed amongst other things, I'm creating a sort of point of focalism that, again, we know changes what people think. Mm. And the T is time frame. If you as a consumer are making a microsecond decision at a fixture, let's say, or reacting to something very quickly as part of a longer journey, then if I spend half an hour talking to you about that, I'm essentially, we're going into a fantasy land that involves a completely different part of your brain. Mm-hmm. I have to identify what the time frame is, and I have to evaluate in a way that, as best as I can, reflects that time frame. So with those five criteria, the more of those you can say yes to, the more confident you can be that what you're looking at is true. The fewer that you can say yes to, the more cautious you should be that what you're looking at doesn't really have any validity at all. Mm. Now, that's not to say it might not have a value if it resonates with something else you're aware of, but the likelihood is it's going to give you false confidence or a misleading read.
Got you. For you, what companies have really tapped into their customer base and demonstrated a clear understanding of what experiences those different segments of customers are looking for? Have you got any good examples of that?
There are two examples I'd go to, and they're very standard examples in a way, but I think they're important examples. So the first is Apple. Now, Apple have been successful because they have been really clear what their proposition is, and they've sought to execute against it constantly.
Yeah.
Not always perfectly.
Yeah.
And of course, no organization will be perfect and not make mistakes.
Do you mind me cutting in there for a second? It's quite interesting. So when I was writing my book, 100 Practical Ways to Improve Customer Experience, I was fortunate enough to interview a man called Tim Kobe. I just met him at an event, and I was telling him about the book I was about to write, and I said, what do you do? And he said, well, I design stores. And I design the Apple stores. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And he actually shared with me the white paper, the business case that he took to Steve Jobs in 1996, because he said, you're not in control of your brand and its destiny, or, you know, how consumers perceive it, because you're selling your brand through other people's channels. So you don't have control over pricing. You don't have control over marketing, content, or anything else. You need to create your own environment so that you can really control how consumers experience the brand. And that was the beginning of the Apple Store. So quite privileged to have access to that. Very interesting as well.
Yeah, fascinating. And, you know, your ability to do that well is entirely dependent on your ability to know as an organization what it is you are and what it is you're trying to represent.
Sure.
And Apple have had the benefit of being very clear about that. Mm. And that, to the best of my knowledge, has not involved going out and asking consumers what it is they think Apple should be. It's by employing people within Apple who have that vision very clearly. And, you know, asking consumers what they want is just such a futile exercise. And, you know, there'd be...
Can I ask you something on that? Because I think there are different trains of thought there. And I think that, you know, asking them what they want when you're developing something completely new. I mean, I can imagine if whoever it was, Jonathan Ive or whoever took the idea for the iPod to Steve Jobs and said, I've got this idea that's going to revolutionize how, you know, consumers listen to music. In most businesses, you know, the person that was being asked that question or being asked for budget would have said, you know, what's the business case? Well, you can't really prove the business case because it's not been done before. But let's take the example of, let's say, a fashion business, for example, that has maybe middle of the road product. Do you not think that there's some validity in when they're creating a range of products, you know, actually engaging customers to some extent and asking them, you know, will you come with us on this journey? This is what we're thinking of producing for the next season and, you know, for autumn, winter, for example, next year. Or do you really think that pretty much across the board, across all categories of products, it's just not worthwhile asking customers?
It's almost not worthwhile asking customers.
Can you tell us why?
Yeah, there are ways of doing it, mm-hmm. but they have to be so carefully managed mm-hmm. that you know, there are very few organisations that are able to do that, mm-hmm. and very few organisations that do. So here's the problem. If we take your example, so here's our new range of fashions that we're going to be bringing out next spring. So yep. if you look at production timelines, now. How, as a consumer, am I going to react to those? Let's assume I'm vaguely fashionable, which we can pretend for the purposes of a podcast I am. How does fashion work? Fashion works actually very much on the unconscious mind. Now, I've certainly had this experience, and let me say for the record, I'm not very fashionable, where I've gone
to comment.
I've gone to my wardrobe, and I've looked at a jumper. It's a perfectly functioning jumper, okay? No holes in it, clean, fits mm-hmm. me well. I looked at it and thought, I don't feel comfortable wearing that. And it's because the colour was actually quite a seasonal colour. And unconsciously, I am somewhat aware that that's not been worn a lot. And therefore, I would feel somehow out from the rest of the tribe, to put it into a sort of evolutionary parlance. So when you're talking to those people about your new fashion range, what are their unconscious associations against which they're judging it? Now, it may very well be that there will be, you know, as happens in fashion, there'll be a kind of a wave of colours that come through, and a lot of companies will be using the same colours. And all of a sudden, you know, bright orange feels comfortable. It feels right. But it doesn't feel right in isolation. So what you're asking people is very much the point I made earlier. You're going into the wrong part of their mind because they don't have all the contextual associations that they will need in order to genuinely react to what they're seeing. Now, there is an interesting example within the world of fashion of a company that has done this very well, and that is the Inditex Group with Zara. Mm-hmm. And what Zara do is they create their ranges using their designers as best they can. And, you know, a good designer, clear of what the brand identity and brand role is, should be able to do that, you would think. And then they put them out into stores. But what they do is they make sure they really listen in stores. Mm-hmm. They don't go soliciting opinions. But if someone comes in and says, well, I quite like this coat, but not sure about the colour, they've based production locally, so in Spain rather than in the Far East. Yep. They've used smaller production runs, and they can, if they collect that feedback and they recognise it, they can align it. And we're not selling much of this. Okay, we'll keep making it. We're going to change the colour of the fabric.
Yeah, they've got that's a great example. I mean, they've got a very short supply chain window. They're able to turn around that stock in a few weeks.
And what they're getting is genuine insight, not bogus insight.
Yeah, so it's insight in the environment when consumers are actually at that point of deciding what they want to buy.
Absolutely. And one of the techniques that I've developed, and essentially the core part of my consultancy business, is a virtual, not in the sense of technology, but in the psychological sense, a virtual version of that form of testing. Now, I couldn't do it with fashion because so much of the context is not something I can create because it's not yet to happen. Yeah. But I can do it with consumer goods. I can do it in service environments because everything else is now and the new thing is dropping into now. Mm-hmm. So I can take now and I can virtually recreate the context, recreate the frame of mind, recreate the time frame, and put in, without identifying it, something new and explore how consumers react to it. And then with a knowledge of how people's minds work, work out what it is that's driving that reaction. Right. So Apple would be a good example. And then another good example, and you know, these are clearly very different experiences, is Amazon. Again, I'm picking big companies that have done well, but I think it's quite helpful to look at big companies that do well and to understand from a psychological point of view how they've got there. And what Amazon have done very well is I think they have at their core recognition they want to make shopping as easy as possible.
Yep,
if you go to their website, it's not very beautiful.
It's one click to purchase.
One click, Amazon Prime. Yeah. You know, to the point, Amazon Marketplace. So even if they don't sell it, they'd rather you were going there first to find out that they don't have it, or you could get it cheaper somewhere else. Yeah. And what they have done is they've worked tirelessly, things like PayPal. When you think about when internet shopping first came along, you had to sit there, you had to type in your name and address, you had to put in your credit card details and all of that nonsense. Now, if you go to a website and they haven't got a very quick form of payment like PayPal, and Apple have speeded that up with, fingerprint loading of passwords and things, it just feels like the biggest waste of your life, to the point where you think, oh, actually, I won't bother.
Yep.
And, of course, that's something that Amazon, for as long as they retain that edge and as long as they're focusing on the length of journeys and the rest of it, you know, can continue to innovate on, and they'll be successful as a result.
I think they're arguably the best example probably today of a brand that understands what it means to put the customer at the heart of all you do, so that all of those levels of convenience that they deliver, I think is second to none. But, you know, very much they take an approach. I mean, if you only have to look at the press to see on a daily basis all the different initiatives that they're planning and the innovations that are not just today but coming down the line. They obviously leverage data extremely well, but turn that into insight to the point where, you know, they're going to predict what we're going to buy and they're going to send it to us before we've even decided to buy it. So that's an interesting concept.
And one other thing I'd say about Amazon that I think is a really important point is that, you know, quite often when you're talking to people in marketing, and I had this conversation with someone who worked in insurance business, you know, they're really preoccupied with how much their brand is loved or cherished. And I don't think Amazon want to be disliked. And, you know, some of their taxation policies might have rubbed people up the wrong way. But what they fundamentally recognise is it's more important to make things easy and be acceptable than to put things in your path as a consumer that are designed to make you love them.
Sure.
But that actually detract from how easy it is to shop with them.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that comes down to that fundamental truth, which is ultimately and increasingly we want things to be easy.
Yeah. Well, probably the best example of that is the Amazon Go store concept, where basically you are automatically debited in some method through your phone, whatever the technology is, when you shop in one of their Amazon Go grocery outlets, which they've launched in the US and they're going to launch in the UK soon. You don't have to take out your debit card, your purse, your wallet, or anything. You literally pick up and go. And I think that's a great example of them thinking about how do we remove the friction that exists in a traditional retail environment and create something that's completely seamless.
Absolutely. And we could go back to Apple and say the same thing. Mm. I mean, my son, who is 16, very into his computers, very into his gaming, sits down when he's talking to me about computing stuff and says, oh, you know, Dad, you could get so much more powerful computer than your Apple One. Yeah. You could even run the Apple operating system on it. It would be a fraction of the price. Why don't you do that? And the answer is quite simply because I spent the first 20 odd years of my life messing around with PCs, trying to get things to work when I added in a peripheral or loaded some new software or whatever else. And with Apple stuff, it works. And
so easy,
the premium I'm prepared to pay for that. Yes. And again, what's it come down to? They've made it easy.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. Getting back to surveys and customers not always, or consumers not always telling us the truth when you're trying to predict what they want. How can you predict what customers might lie about in a survey? How do you do that?
Essentially, any time you're asking them a question that involves them talking about their attitudes or opinions or what they'll do in the future, you should presume that it's a lie. Mm. So most of the time, it will be a lie. And when I say a lie, I don't mean that it's a willful deceit on their part. I mean that you're asking them questions that they just can't answer. So to give you an example, the Financial Conduct Authority was looking at add-on insurance purchases. So you go and buy your new laptop, do you want to buy some insurance with that? They looked at this market. They said, we think these companies offering these products are making too much money. So we'll do a survey and we'll ask people why they bought the add-on insurance that they bought. And when you ask people, they said, well, because I thought it was a good deal. I was happy with what I bought. I thought it was a good price. I'm not an idiot, essentially, they were saying. But when they conducted an experiment, because fortunately they have a behavioral economics unit, where they varied how easy it was to shop around. When they just gave people one product listed, over 60% of people bought that product. They didn't shop around. Mm-hmm. When they listed some alternatives, only 16% of people bought that same product. Most of them bought something else. The difficulty that they gave people to shop around was one browser click.
Yep.
So all you were asking people to do was to click on a different browser tab to do the shopping around, and 50-odd% of people, the difference, didn't bother.
Right.
So what they realised was actually this was an issue to do with the way the purchase was framed and the amount of effort involved. And as a result of that, essentially these sellers were exploiting consumers or exploiting the way that consumers think.
Yes.
And taking advantage of it.
Right. Okay. You find that businesses generally are willing to engage in feedback on their customer service strategies when you talk to them?
On customer service strategies, broadly, no.
Right.
And the best example, I think what happens is if they have they think they have a consumer-centric approach to service, because what they do is they get together a load of consumers and they ask them what they want from service. Yeah. And I'll give you an example of this with an electrical store, Comet, which is no longer in business, which may tell its own story. So Comet did this, and they found out that people wanted to be greeted when they got to the shop, and they wanted to be asked if they needed any help and these kinds of things.
Yep.
So out of that, they thought this is really important. So we'll develop a mystery shopper program. So we'll tell our staff this is what they need to do. We'll send them into stores with these mystery shoppers, and we'll get a score. And then we'll get the score. We can bonus them based on how well they're doing, and we'll know whether or not our service is getting better. Now, what this completely failed to appreciate was that they were getting marked on whether or not they said hello when someone walked in. Mm. But if you're walking into a big electrical store and you know you want to go and buy a television, and you see the television at the back and you quicken your pace and you walk past the person and they say hello to you, now you've got a social problem, because you don't want to be rude, but you never wanted to speak to that person. And they've spoken to you as you go past.
Sure.
And in a sense, your body language was saying, I'm on a mission. I'm going to go and get something. Don't talk to me. I want to go and sort something out. And then the person gets to where the televisions are, and they're looking at a television. Someone comes up behind them and says, can I help you? Now, being spoken to from someone behind you who you can't see is another uncomfortable thing. Mm. So now you've done two things which in principle are good things, but in the context
in reality,
in which they occur,
are very
uncomfortable. Yeah. And some people feel uncomfortable there.
Yeah.
Now, what happened in tandem with this, though, was that the operations people who ran the stores were seeing their scores go up and up and up.
Mm.
And they were being bonused on those scores. So they had no interest in changing the system, because this system said they did well.
Mm.
And the metrics they were working against were ones they felt they were improving against.
Yeah.
So if that is the mentality that's driving service, and if there is a desire, one, to ask customers what they want and to measure it in a completely non-contextually sensitive way, you're on a hiding to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, service is about design. It's about creativity. And you can observe what's going on. You should be able to see whether service is positive or not. You can look at people and say, do these people look happy? Are they leaving satisfied? You know, do I judge this exchange as having been a positive, constructive exchange or not?
Mm.
And from that, it's then a creative and cultural job to put in place the right elements of service that will work.
Mm.
And also, if, you know, like the Apple Store example, it's that, well, if we really want to differentiate on this, we're going to need to create something that doesn't exist. And again, I can't come back to it often enough. Consumers will not tell you about this thing that doesn't yet exist that they will enjoy when they get there.
Mm.
They didn't want internet shopping, you know, which seems crazy. People, oh, it's very dangerous. I don't want to give my credit card details online. And then they get drawn into it, and then they realise actually they love it, and then they realise they're never going to go to those high street stores anymore, and we see the big changes happening.
You talked about culture, and I think culture is massively important there, both in terms of ensuring you've got the right people in the first place coming into the business that want to, you know, deliver the right and appropriate level of service, but also in empowering people that are in those sort of customer-facing roles that they can, you know, step outside the box and deliver the right type of service. I think too often we end up telling people all the things that they shouldn't be doing. And it creates almost the antithesis of that, doesn't it? The opposite effect.
Absolutely. And there was a wonderful example I heard, and I think it was probably back in the early 90s. Mm. And I can't remember who gave this example, but there was a guy who went into a Haagen-Dazs store and he walked up to the counter and said, I'd like a scoop of pralines and cream.
Yeah.
And the guy behind the counter said, oh, you've got to take a ticket. You know, like they have at the deli counter sometimes. And he said, pretty sure I'm next.
Yeah.
And he says, no, that's the policy. You've got to take a ticket. So he takes the ticket and the guy presses the button and he's standing there with 78 and the guy goes 75. You know, so the point being that absolutely you have to empower people to take responsibility and find people who care about the experience. I'm so fortunate that I have probably the best train station in the country.
Right.
Because it's...
Where is that? Because everybody would love to know.
That is in...
I think everybody will be moving there.
It is a place called Shelford. It's not on a brilliant train line. It's a bit of a slow train line.
Right, okay.
But there is a lady there who works for Greater Anglia called Angela, who loves what she does and thinks about how can I make using this station better. She will give you the best ticket because she knows that she can. She knows that a split ticket at a certain place will be better value than one going straight from A to B.
Yep.
She will give you sweets. There's a water machine there. There's a little free library that she's created. She picks up the free newspapers that otherwise wouldn't get there. Mm-hmm. So there are some available on her way in. She keeps the station clean. She gets to know the customers. She cares about it. And we all benefit from that enormously. Now, that's down to her and her feeling like she can do that in that small station environment. Mm-hmm. But do I see that replicated everywhere else I go? No, of course not. But it's how you find people like that and create the culture where that's encouraged rather than criticised or seen as, oh, well, you know, there is all these... 200 lists of procedures and processes that you've got to do that actually make no difference to customers, that you end up with the problems.
Have you ever told Greater Anglia about Angela?
I have.
Yeah.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, I hope they reward her accordingly, because we could certainly do with more people like that in not only our train stations, but in our high street stores and other environments around the place. But always great to hear about people who, you know, go the extra mile. I love that. And particularly when they're not necessarily, I mean, I don't know what the culture of Greater Anglia is, whether that's a cultural thing, but probably more specific to her as a human being. But isn't it great when you get people who just want to serve and want to provide the best experience? It's so enjoyable and so rewarding and just a great thing. I think probably more than anything, because in this country it doesn't happen as frequently as it should do.
Well, and I think one of the reasons it doesn't happen particularly frequently in this country is that in many instances, and I think this is a legacy of the class system, we regard serving other people as something that is essentially a very negative thing. It's a low status thing.
Sure.
And that's one of the reasons why I think in other countries you see quite a different approach to service. And that's difficult to get over. And that's why I think, you know, probably average service is more the norm than good service. But there are ways of tackling it. And it's one down to the psychological profile of the people that you employ. I think John Lewis have created good longer term rather than shorter term goals that encourage that. I think Pret A Manger have done a very good job of creating a team atmosphere that says, actually, we recognise how you work together matters to you. So that will be reflected in how we bring other people into the store.
But interestingly, most of their frontline colleagues, I think, are foreign nationals.
A lot of them are, yeah. But I think that that's a kind of... A secondary factor in a way, and just reflects the nature of they've got a lot of London-based stores, and you know they bring people into that environment.
Sure, but I think I agree. But I think it to some extent doesn't it also talk to the fact that, you know, at the moment in this country we still have that mindset that serving somebody is almost beneath us, and therefore that's not an industry that we aspire to work in, which is why a lot of those service sectors, you know, end up employing people that have come from other countries.
Yes, I think there is an element of that, certainly. Yeah. But I think we should be getting to a point where we can move away from that.
Totally.
However, these echoes through history can have a very long series of repeats. And I certainly feel that we see that in broadly in customer service.
Well, sorry to mention the B word, but it'll be interesting to see what the implications are if we do end up Brexiting, you know, in relation to... what the implications of that are on the service sector, because again, arguably at the moment, there's an awful lot of people that have come to this country to work in that sector. So it'll be very interesting to see how that all plays out. Listen, that's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Philip, and really great insight. That's another book I'm now going to have to read. Feels like there's a bit of learning for me there. Despite having written 100 Practical Ways to Improve Customer Experience, I do feel that consumerology is something that's going to teach me a thing or two, which I could certainly leverage. So I hope you've enjoyed it. You enjoyed the conversation.
Very much so. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Your consulting business, is that just under your own name or is that a separate brand?
Shift Consultancy.
Shiftconsultancy.co.uk.
.co.uk.
There you go. Well, Philip Graves, thank you very much for joining me. My name is Martin Newman. That was my third podcast around consumer focus. I hope you all enjoyed it and I look forward to talking to you again sometime soon. Thank you very much.